next to her sister, turned away, grasping her bow between determined fingers, drew her first arrow, took aim at the spot just above the torchlight, fired, drew another, fired again. The shouts of pursuit quickly morphed to screams of pain, the clattering of falling bodies tumbling over each other. Dropped torches bounced across the ground before going still, halos of light filling the tunnel. And still Gwen fired arrow after arrow, wasting none, killing at will, sending them all into the void they believed in. Finally, when she reached back for another arrow, she came up empty. Slowly, the torches advanced once more.
"Climb,"
she hissed, grabbing Raven under the armpit and shoving her against the rock wall. Raven shook her head.
"I am spent."
Footsteps closed in. Even if they started climbing now, the pitmasters were too close, would pull them from the wall. Gwen could keep fighting, could kill more of them, but they had her if she stayed. If she wanted to save herself, she had to go now, with or without the Sand Sisters. Either way, Raven would die, and with her the hope of peace between the East and Caleb. Slowly, Gwen turned to face her last fight. Warily, the men stalked forward, their weapons glittering. Somewhere in the night, something shrieked. Ciri. Her soul's scent was so close now she could taste it. There was something off about it, the coppery odor of blood mixing with her usual smell of sweat and sand. Deep inside, she felt Raven's pain like a red-hot knife in her heart. Ciri shrieked, diving for the ramshackle city that seemed to be crammed together, the streets narrow, the buildings tall, sharing walls on both sides. Pitts spotted a significant portion of the city, some small, barely large enough for Ciri to fit inside, and others larger as she flew over them, until they culminated in a grand arena that rivaled the training area for the Dragonia in Calypso. Inside there was chaos. Two leggers ran amok, some screaming, others stopping to point inside the giant pit where there were bodies. Ciri tried to sense their heartbeats, but most were silent. A few moved, writhing in agony. Everywhere else, men ran holding weapons, charging down staircases into the tunnels that must run beneath the pits. Ciri circled the area twice, letting her senses roam. With each pass, she could feel the nearness of her soul. The little girl, with the hair so dark it almost looked blue. She remembered when Raven named her. Ciri had flowed from her lips so easily, like it had been waiting there from the moment she was born, the moment both of them were born. All the years they spent in each other's company seemed to angle toward this very moment in time. The dragon's senses sharpened further, a blade of iron honed down to a single point. The stone shaft was a beacon, and she knew Raven lay somewhere beneath it. She dove, shrieking once more, flames already crisping her breath. Rather than attacking the shaft, she chose a portion of ground just beyond it, a stone walkway that had a slight echo beneath it. A tunnel. Fire erupting from her maw. Ciri crashed into the earth. Raven Sands. The call seemed to come from a great distance away, a heart-piercing cry, as the earth began to move around them. Raven clutched Whisper's motionless body, using her own body to protect her sisters as rocks rained down from above. She smiled against the pain, lance pricks on her back, her shoulders, her scalp. Pitmasters screamed as the tunnel collapsed on their heads. Their screams didn't last long. Gwen pressed against her side.
"What is happening?" she screamed. "My soul," Raven said. "My soul will save us."
How it was possible, she did not know. And yet, she did.
"She is perfection. She is Caleb."
With another shuddering crash, the destroyed tunnel caved in further, until a spot of natural moonlight shone through. A shadow blocked it a moment later, broken only by a thin gout of flame.
"Holy awe,"
Gwen whispered.
"No," Raven said. "This time, it's fire. And her name is Ciri."
Gwendolyn Storm. She knew this dragon, with its red scales and spiked back and tail. She felt its voice in her head as she did before, that deep ancient thunder that spoke of a greatness she could never hope to achieve.
"You are an ally,"
the voice said. The dragon. I am trying to be, she thought. Her jaw locked so tight she feared her teeth might crack. Come. The dragon lowered its head into the tunnel. Raven easily clambered up, using the spikes as handholds. She looked back. Hoist my sister up. Gwen obeyed, only letting go of the girl's warm body once Raven had her securely in her arms. It was time to part ways, Gwen knew. This wasn't her world. She didn't ride dragons or fight alongside Calypsians. It was time for her to return to Feria and seek a future she wasn't certain she deserved. She turned away from the dragon and began to climb the shaft, which was now riddled with cracks but still standing. Like her. Gwendolyn, Raven said. She didn't turn, didn't want to turn, didn't want to face the woman she'd blooded and nearly killed. Come with us. Tears bit at her eyes. She shook her head. She had no right to compassion, nor forgiveness. Those had to be earned, slowly, step by step. Please? She turned. Raven nodded at her, extending the hand that still worked. Gwen didn't deserve to take it. But she did. She did. The dragon exploded from the ground, its wings buffeting the air like the edges of a storm. And for the first time in her life, Gwen didn't feel angry or afraid at the sound. She felt only sad. Second Interlude. Crimea. The Horde. Helmuth sat in a throne he didn't want, watching his horde sleep. They were scattered amongst the palace court, resisting their thick, dirty forms, where lords and ladies once stood to announce their meaningless petitions and settle their petty disputes. Some were sleeping. Others ground against each other, creating the next generation of destroyers. Some gnawed on the bones of humans and Mongol beasts alike. Watching them, he recalled when he'd first sought them out, how unprepared he'd been. They'd almost killed him during that first meeting, but somehow he'd survived. He'd tried again, growing stronger with each attempt, until he'd gained their respect, their belief in what he could show them, the power he was able to unlock once he'd taken them from groups of disorganized infighting barbarian tribes to an organized machine of destruction. He remembered the day they chanted his name, stomping their feet and beating their massive drums. Kla, gra, thum, thum, kla, gra, thum, thum, kla, gra, thum, thum. The memory faded, drawing a thin smile to his face. Soon they would have to move on, for the Horde was a migratory species, subsisting off the plenty of others, never stopping to create their own food and shelter. Helmuth stood, shouldering the hammer he'd held across his lap. He turned, drawing it back. Then he struck again and again, shattering the back of the throne, breaking the armrests from the sides, destroying the base. All around him, the Horde clambered forward to watch, giddy with excitement. When the job was finished, he turned toward them, speaking to them in their language. It is time. The Big Blue beckons us. We sail to the great land of my father. He paused. There we shall drink the blood of kings. The Horde roared and beat their chests and flashed their teeth and claws. They shall be the fall of all things, he thought, and I shall show them the way. Part 3. Anis, Lisbeth, Taryn, Rhea, Christoph, Dietrich, Gareth. For as the fire's embers darken into night, and the smoke that blinds, that burns, that fades, so shall the lives of those that play the games of war vanish in the coming light. Japati, famous Calypsian poet. 28. The Northern Kingdom, Castle Hill. Anis Garrick. Terran's lips painted a trail of fire down her abdomen, his tongue smooth against her skin, tasting her, kneading her. His hands roved over her body desperately, as if searching for water in the desert. She wanted him, too. She needed him. He moved lower. She moaned, pulling him up, finding his mouth, slipping her tongue between his lips. From the moment they first kissed, there had never been anything awkward between them, their passion like a wildfire, always tracing the thinnest of lines between control and chaos. The temptation was great, to escape, to forget, to lose herself in the safety of Terin's arms, in the smell of his hair still damp from his bath, in the taste of his lips. She didn't want to forget, didn't want to escape, needed to remember. How close it had been, how she'd almost lost Zelda in the attack. How the sleeping knights had defied her command. How Christoph Metz had swooped in at the last moment, saving the day.
"I'm sorry," she said, breaking off the kiss.
"Tell me what you need, and I shall give it to you," Terin said, his voice rough.
She loved the way he looked at her, all of her. The expression on his porcelain face was so earnest, it took her breath away.
"How is he mine? To talk, I feel as though I'm a lost lamb searching for my flock."
"You're the mightiest lamb I've ever laid eyes on. The most beautiful, too."
"Thank you. But it doesn't change the fact that I'm lost."
He cradled her head in the crook of his shoulder.
"You're not lost. Not really. You have me, Archer, Christoph and Jonius and Lisbeth. And even Dietrich. We're all here for you. We await your command."
And that was the problem. Everyone expected her to tell them what to do, where to go, who to fight. But what if she didn't know? What if she needed someone to tell her? Ever since her brother, Bane, had murdered her father, it felt as if her enemies had been circling like vultures, pecking and clawing chunks of her away, her kingdom, too. Sometimes from within, like her uncle and the Brotherhood, and other times from without, like the two attacks by the Easterners she'd already faced.
"My kingdom. I am the queen."
It was a silly reminder, but sometimes she needed to be silly.
"We await your command."
"Stop being a soldier in the queen's army,"
Anise said. Terin started to object, but she interrupted.
"I mean right now, when we are alone. Be my friend, my lover, my soul. Please."
Terin nodded once. When he spoke, his voice was husky.
"Of course, my queen."
He chuckled at his own joke. Anise knew what she wanted to do, what she had to do. She'd known for a long time. The only reason she hadn't acted thus far, delaying for the last few weeks, was because she knew it was the opposite of what everyone expected of her.
"Stop being weak. I feel like I've been hanging from a branch with one hand for so long. With each battle, one of my fingers is peeled away."
"What do you have left?"
"A thumb, Terin. Just a thumb."
"Then I better prepare to catch you, though I fear my armor will not properly cushion your fall."
"Very funny. Seriously, though, the kingdom is in turmoil. No one is collecting taxes or tracking the royal treasury, while I spend coin hand over fist to reconstitute, train and outfit an army, continue to pay the castle staff and, to make matters worse, rebuild not one but two of the largest cities in the realm, Darin and Blackstone."
Terin raised an eyebrow.
"Sounds bad."
"It is bad."
"What are you going to do?"
"Change the game. Stop treading water and swim."
"How?"
Anise paused, gathering her thoughts.
"Before I left for the hinterlands, I sent a message to Crimea," she started,
finding her words like one might stumble through the dark, one step at a time. Terin propped his head on his hand, quirking an eyebrow.
"Trying to reinstate our trade agreement."
His finger absently traced a path between her breasts. She quivered, determined to concentrate on the conversation she'd asked for.
"Yes, but not only that. I requested aid. I asked for help. We needed allies, and I couldn't be certain the Sleeping Knights even existed, or if they did, that I would be able to find them. In case I didn't survive the journey..."
"You did survive. Beautifully, I might add."
That gentle finger reached her abdomen, her belly button. She waved away his compliment, watching him draw molten circles on her skin,
No, a figure eight. The symbol for eternity, she thought. The point is, I wanted the kingdom to survive, even if I didn't.
Of course you did. That's why you're the queen this kingdom deserves. But what are you getting at?
Anise took Terin's hand in hers, warding off the distraction. His fingers felt warm in her grasp.
The Crimeans never responded. I've sent three more messages since we retook Castle Hill. Those have gone unanswered, too.
Perhaps they've withdrawn from the Four Kingdoms for a reason. Maybe it's too volatile, and they fear losing more merchant vessels.
Anise gripped his hand harder.
That's what I thought, too. And then this came.
She reached over and plucked a page from her side table. It had been resting face down the entire time. She turned it over to reveal the smeared ink, the bloodstains, the barely legible message.
The Horde. They come.
The last word trailed away, the line meandering to the edge and off the page. All the letters were smeared and speckled with crimson drops. Terin ran his fingers over the page.
This could have come from anywhere. But probably not in the Four Kingdoms, because it came via pigeon.
The bird was injured, hardly able to fly. The fact that it made it across the Crimean Sea is half a miracle. After delivering the message to the belfry, it dropped dead. Terin, the only messages we get via birds are from Crimea.
Anise, this could be a threat. Long has Crimea coveted the Four Kingdoms.
I know.
They fell into silence for a few moments, each lost in their own thoughts. Finally, Terin broke the quiet.
You want to go to Crimea?
It wasn't a question. As usual, Terin knew her mind as well as she did. She answered anyway.
Yes. If it's a threat, I want to face it head on, through face-to-face negotiations. I have nothing to lose at this point. We need trade with the Crimeans to survive, at least until we can rebuild. I will go to Crimea, and I'd like you to come with me.
As you command?
No, not because I command it. Because you want to. Because you believe in me.
Terin breathed deeply.
I do, on both accounts. But the other,
they can make their own choices. They will not all understand. But this is what I need to do. If there is another threat, whether from the Crimeans or another power, one no one is yet aware of,
the Four Kingdoms will be doomed.
Terin finished.
Crimea is a powerful nation. Defeating them would be no easy feat.
We don't know that they were defeated. This could all be a misunderstanding.
True, but I must know. There are two other options. Do nothing. Guard our borders, rebuild our kingdom. We can do that anyway. We will do that.
And the other option?
Open war. Join Rhea, Loren, and Gareth Ironclad, our prior enemies, and march on Fanes. Risk more lives in a battle far from our borders, but at least we would have allies again.
Terin nodded. She could see the muscles in his jaw tighten, and sensed the voice in his head. The voice that sometimes spoke in her head, too. It wanted war. Wanted blood.
What of the sleeping knights?
She sighed.
Yes, the ancient warriors had saved them, twice now. But they were hard to control, and even with Lisbeth, she knew she couldn't hope to control them now. They will do as they will. But I must go to Crimea.
Then I will go with you, even if I'm the only one.
Anise smiled, her muscles uncoiling. The stress and strain of days agonizing over this decision fell away. Finally, she allowed herself to melt into him.
There is one other thing I need of you.
He knew what to do without being told. 29. The Northern Kingdom, Castle Hill. Lisbeth Lorne. The knights were restless, which seemed to be their normal state of being these days. Lisbeth watched their souls, most of which were a bright shade of orange, as if hovering between action and inaction. Waiting. For what, she did not know. That was a lie. She knew what they wanted. Violence. War. They were a horde set to trample the four kingdoms under their trod, until none were left but those in the northern kingdom who they'd sworn to protect.
They are my army to command, and I failed.
Lisbeth hated feeling helpless. She remembered the hopelessness as she'd tried to delve into the Night's Souls, that deep unending pit that spiraled down, down, down.
"We must move on," they said as one.
"No," she said. "Not until your queen commands it."
"We do not take orders from you, nor the queen. We only obey that which is for the good of the kingdom."
"As determined by whom?"
"Our souls."
And that was the crux of it. Lisbeth's power came from her soul mark, but if she couldn't use it on these knights, she might as well part ways with them.
"No,"
she thought, determination coursing through her.
"You must keep trying. You set them free. They are your responsibility. The blood they spill is your blood, too."
"You will sail with the Queen to Crimea," Lisbeth commanded.
They'd received the news from Queen Anise earlier that day, and she'd been arguing with the knights ever since.
"No,"
they said, their wills, their souls, heaped on top of each other, an impenetrable wall.
"We will march south. Our enemies must fall."
She couldn't change their minds, couldn't bend them to her will, nor the Queen's. But there was another option.
"Then I shall go with you."
"As you will," they said. "It matters not to us."
Lisbeth didn't know if she could change the fate of the four kingdoms, stop the war that was approaching like a tsunami, but she was determined to try. This, she knew, was her true purpose. Not to bring war, but to stop it. 30. The Northern Kingdom, Castle Hill. Anise Garrick. 3 Mammothen had survived the sellsword slaughter, including Chantilly, the gentle giant favoured by her aunt, though she was lame. One of her large hoofs would never be the same, and she would always walk with a slight limp.
"Kind of like the North," Anise thought. "Injured, but powerful just the same."
Zelda held out the biggest carrot Anise had ever seen, and the beast slurped it from her fingers with its massive pink tongue. Her aunt patted the creature's rough trunk and began polishing one of its curling tusks with a rag. She did it with one hand, her other arm in a sling, pulled tight against her abdomen.
"I'm going to miss this old girl," Zelda said.
Anise said,
"Auntie, you don't have to go with us. You've been through an ordeal. Take the time to rest and recover. We'll be back before you know it."
"And miss out on all the fun? Unless you command me to stay, I'm coming."
She narrowed her eyes in Anise's direction and jutted out her broad Garrick jaw as if daring her to contradict her. Terin snorted. Dietrich guffawed, jabbing his sword into a bale of hay. Her brother, Archer, was ignoring the conversation completely, rubbing down his favourite black stallion. Christoph stood stiffly, uncomfortably. Sojonius was an ever-present comfort. Though she knew fathomless depths of pain and regret were hidden beneath his stalwart expression, he never wavered, never showed his self-doubt in her presence. Sometimes she wished he would, to show that he was human. Anise said,
"Very well. We leave for Blackstone on the morrow. A ship will be waiting."
Anise was still surprised by the stream she had received from Night's End. Her cousin, Queen Rhea Loren, hadn't been angered by Anise's refusal to lend her armies for the attack on Fanes. Instead, she'd wished Anise well on her journey, and even offered her own ship, Roth's Chosen, for the voyage across the Crimean Sea.
"What say the rest of you?"
"I go where you go," Terin said immediately.
Not a surprise, but the certainty of his response still sent warmth through her. Sojonius said,
"I as well, my queen."
His eyes gave away nothing. She nodded, looking at Christoph.
"Sir, you have done a great service to the kingdom already. I will understand if you stay to continue your work with your company of soldiers."
"If you'll have me, I will ride with you," he said. "But I request that I bring several of my soldiers, if it pleases the Queen."
"Like Private Sheary," Archer said, finally joining the conversation.
He winked at the knight, who turned bright red. "She is one of several women I was considering for the mission."
"Oh, really?" Archer said. "Juggling women, are you? Perhaps I could learn a thing or two from you."
Christoph frowned. "I've never given much thought to juggling. It seems a rather pointless endeavour. And juggling women, unless they were very small, seems impossible. As for learning from me, your footwork while dueling does require some work. I could help if you—"
"Sir," Anise said,
cutting him off before the confusing conversation took any other unexpected turns.
"It does please me. Feel free to invite Private Sheary along, and I would be honoured to have you in my service once more."
He bowed, still looking uncomfortable, and then departed. Sir Dietrich turned to follow him.
"Sir, you have given me no answer," Anise said.
He froze, turning slowly to face her, as if she held a sword to his throat.
"Why does he look so uncomfortable? I'm not even holding a boot to throw at him, although I suppose I could get one off my feet quick enough."
It dawned on her.
"You're not coming," she said.
He looked away.
"I..."
His eyes returned to hers, certain now.
"No, I am staying. Though I understand the reasons for the voyage, I have my own reasons for staying. Will you march south with the sleeping knights?"
Lisbeth Lorne had informed her earlier that the knights were determined to travel south to
protect the kingdom from its enemies.
"Yes." She was saddened by his decision. Though they'd had their ups and downs, she considered him a friend, one of only a few. Still,
"I wish you well. May we meet again when we both return to the north."
There was something in his expression, in the purse of his lips.
"I feel as if I've failed you, my queen," he said.
This was a rare occasion where they spoke without one or both of them offering a joke or bit of banter. The moment felt important.
"Sir, you have failed no one in this life, least of all your queen and country."
He closed his eyes, his lungs releasing a breath.
"Thank you. It has been an honour to serve you. I shall do my best to represent you wherever I go."
"I know you will," she said. "May your ass be protected from flying boots from this day forward."
His stone face cracked and he smiled, before saluting and departing the same way Christoph had left. Anise turned toward Archer, who'd gone back to caring for the horse.
"Brother, what is your decision?"
He turned and looked at her with that cocksure expression she'd always envied.
"Need you ask? I'm with you. To the hinterlands, to Crimea, wherever. So long as there are exotic women to meet."
She rolled her eyes, but knew her brother well enough to read between the false lightness. He had her back, and she would have his. 31. The Northern Kingdom, Castle Hill. Terrin Sheary.
"Have you heard the news?"
Terrin asked the blacksmith, watching as she hammered the blade of a red-hot sword. In her element, Fay was a sight, sparks flying around her as her biceps tightened her skin, which was sheened with sweat. Her boy short hair was beginning to fall to her forehead, and Terrin knew she would use a dagger to hack it off soon enough. She wouldn't want to risk it catching fire. Watching her, he felt something warm inside of him, a kinship with this woman that felt almost blood-based. Fay paused for a moment, but didn't look up. After a second, she resumed her hammering, shouting over the ruckus.
"About the Queen's voyage? Aye."
"And?"
Terrin shouted.
"And what?"
"Are you coming?"
Finally, Fay stopped, lifting the fiery blade with a gloved hand, inspecting its edge. She plunged it into a cool water bath with a hiss, looked at him.
"No."
"No?"
"I'm staying here. Castle Hill is my home now. Her Highness is leaving me in charge of weaponry and armour for her army."
Terrin raised an eyebrow, feeling silly for not having known. Then again,
"What army?
She has a few hundred soldiers at most.
And they all need armor and weapons. Plus, more join every day. The people are hearing her call. She has saved them twice now.
That was true, Terrin knew. Her entire life it had been Archer who'd been adored by the people, while Anise had been largely ignored. Now the tables had turned.
She deserves their adoration. She deserves the hell-frozen moons.
Still, Terrin wasn't ready to give up that easily. First, travelling on the tundra with her, and then again when encamped in Darren, he'd learned that Fae had a calming effect on him, the ability to cut through his excuses and anger like no one else could, even Anise.
"But can't you delegate to the other blacksmiths in your employ?"
"Why should I?"
"Because I want you to come with us."
She sighed.
"Terrin, I appreciate you saying that, but you don't need me any more. You have your new armor. The Morningstar is in pristine condition. You have Anise again, and I'm still alone, which is fine. I'm better alone."
"Wait, what? What are you saying? That you were hoping you and I..."
He gestured to his own chest awkwardly. She rolled her eyes.
"No, you giant fool of a man. You think too highly of yourself. I don't want any man, not like that, anyway."
Terrin did feel a fool. Though he'd never felt any kind of a romantic connection between them, he hadn't realized what she really wanted.
"Because you never asked." "I'm sorry. I didn't know."
"It's fine," she said, starting to turn back toward the forge.
"I still think you should come. You can be alone with us."
She laughed, half turning back. He smiled, glad he could still surprise her with his foolishness. She sighed deeply, and her smile faltered.
"Thank you. Truly," she said. "But I don't ever want to set foot in Blackstone again."
"Again?"
To Terran's knowledge, Fae had never even been to the famed war city.
"Why not?"
"It's a long story. Perhaps I'll tell it to you sometime."
Again, she started to turn away. He took two big steps forward and grabbed her shoulder. Her face registered surprise as he pulled her into a giant hug. At first she felt as stiff as a board, but little by little she softened, hugging him back. He wouldn't press her about Blackstone. When she was ready to tell him, she would.
"I'm going to miss you, Fae,"
Terrin said into her hair. She laughed.
"I'm going to miss you too, you big lug."
32. The Western Kingdom, the Forbidden Plains. Rhea Loren.
"Ruth, is this your plan for me? Is this what you wanted? Is this my punishment, my atonement for my sins?"
It was the same prayer Rhea had willed into her head each time they stopped, days fading into nights, drifting into days, their passage south long and tedious. If Ruth was listening, she never received an answer. Initially, they'd stuck to the western road, riding hard, the miles falling away under their horses' hooves. Sometimes the supply train would fall a day or more behind, and they would be forced to stop and wait. Rhea hated those days the most. The isolation. The feeling that she was a leper, avoided by all. Stares ceaselessly skittered upon her, before dancing away if she caught them. Her cousins, even Gaia, stayed well away. The only solace she took was that Leo, despite his pleading, had been ordered to remain in Night's End. She hoped one day she would see him again, if only to tell him that she wasn't angry with him, that she understood why he did what he did.
"I am poison."
It was that thought that hurt the most.
"Because of the child inside me. Am I poisoning it, too?"
She shook away the thought. 3 days ago, they'd departed from the road as it veered on a more easterly course. Now they rode hard across the Forbidden Plains, a desolate land of scrub grass and stunted, thorny plants that the horses avoided, else they fall lame from the poisonous barbs. These plains had long protected the West from invasion over ground, as they were empty of water and devoid of sustenance. The only creatures that lived here were small and bony, rodents that lived in underground burrows. Rarely did they pop their heads up as Rhea's army thundered past.
No, not my army. Not any more.
The reminder made her clench her teeth together so hard it made her jaw ache. Her life was spiraling out of control. The desire to do something drastic, to find a way to break free of the ropes that chafed her wrists and ankles, to steal a knife, to stab her eldest cousin Sai, to lay him low like she had his brother Jove.
How dare they betray me? How dare they try to steal my throne? To take it for themselves, or give it to Rhone, who grew up in the south, who—
Rhea gasped, and she realized her fingers were clenched tight against her palms, her nails digging in. Warm blood flowed freely, watering the brittle grass.
Rhea?
Her head jerked up, startled by the sudden voice after so much silence. Gaia, her youngest cousin, stood before her. Rhea had been so lost in her dark thoughts that she hadn't seen her approach. The guards were still close at hand, gripping the hilts of their swords, ready to drag them shrieking from their scabbards at a moment's notice. One of the Furies pretended not to watch, but Rhea could feel her icy gaze.
Gaia,
Rhea croaked, a voice rusty from days of disuse.
I...
Gaia trailed away, looking unsure of what to say. Her green eyes seemed softer than before, finding Rhea before skittering away to her feet. She wore a white purity dress cinched at the waist for riding. Though she was travelling with the company for the time being, she wouldn't be going to war.
I'm sorry,
Rhea said.
For everything.
Gaia looked up, her expression fierce once more.
You truly killed him. You murdered Jove, and blamed it on the king's bane.
Lying would have been so easy. She'd done it for months.
Yes. After he ordered the Furies to punish me, I felt broken. Then I felt angry, so angry.
Gaia closed her eyes, and Rhea fully expected her to turn and walk away or lash out. Instead, when she opened them, there were tears in her eyes.
I am sorry about what Jove did to you, what he allowed the Furia to do.
Surprised, Rhea's hands unconsciously went to her face, her fingers tracing the lines of her scars.
It was cruel,
Rhea said.
But I had broken Western law. I deserved it. I deserve this.
Gaia shook her head.
No one deserves to be abused, tortured. Jove was wrong. But what you did was just as bad. Worse.
She stopped suddenly, as if something occurred to her.
What of the child you bear? Who is the father? This Greece jolly criminal? His true name is Grey Aris. And yes, he is the father.
Speaking the truth felt strange, almost liberating. Her hand settled on her round belly. Despite her isolation, she'd been treated well, given soft pillows to sleep on, a large tent to shelter inside, plenty of food and water.
Despite all I've done, my cousins are more caring than I would have been if the situation was reversed.
The thought made her feel as shallow as a puddle drying in the sun.
Oh, Rhea, how did we get to this place?
She hated the sympathy in her cousin's tone, the pity. She didn't deserve it. She was about to tell her as much when another form materialized through the dusky gloom. Gaia, leave her. It was Sai, his expression dark, his armor darker. The gray in his hair flashed silver under the brightening moon's light. He was flanked by the other two Furies, their own plate as red as blood. Gaia offered Rhea one more sorrowful glance, and then turned away. Rhea was just starting to drift off to sleep when she heard voices outside her tent. She lifted her head slightly, listening. The camp was usually quiet by this time. Sai was a strict commander, not permitting the foolishness that oft accompanied military camps. A loud thud jolted her. It was followed by a groan, there and gone so quickly she might have imagined it. In the dark, she saw the tent flap swing open, a pair of white eyes peering in at her.
Rhea, are you awake? What is happening? Gaia?
Her cousin crawled through the opening, something gleaming in her hand. Rhea's breath caught.
A knife?
She released her breath.
So, it comes to this. A life for a life.
She cared not for her own life. Not any more. But the child.
Please, spare the life inside.
Gaia cut the ropes around her ankles, silencing her plea. As Rhea's mouth fell open, her cousin sliced the cords on her wrists, whispering,
We must hurry. The change of guard will occur soon.
Rhea grabbed her wrist.
I don't understand. You've been wronged. By Jove. By me. By my siblings. Ennis was the only one who remained loyal to you, but even he stood by and did nothing while they carved your face. But I... What I did to Jove, the lies, banishing Ennis. None of us are without blame.
Rhea tried to contradict her, but Gaia held her hand.
None of us, myself included. We are all Lorenz. We should start acting like it. Now come, the night has wings.
Out of the tent they went, into the cool night air. Hand in hand they ran, Rhea's head swiveling around at the shadows. Nearby, a guard lay crumpled on the ground, his sword still in its scabbard.
Is he dead?
Rhea hissed.
No,
Gaia whispered back.
He'll have a nasty bump when he wakes up, but that is all. But the Furia, they will ride us down. Distracted for the moment, but time is running out. How did you...
Just then, a large form materialized from the gloom. A guard, wearing full plate.
It's over,
Rhea thought. She would plead for Gaia to be forgiven, convince Sai that it had all been Rhea's idea. The man saluted Gaia, said, This way, hurry. He turned and trotted off in the opposite direction.
My man,
Gaia said, reading the confusion on Rhea's face.
Come.
She pulled her after him, and Rhea had no choice but to follow. She didn't know where they were going, but something about it felt like a second chance. 33. The Northern Kingdom, approaching Blackstone. Sir Christoph Metz. Sir Christoph Metz was perturbed, greatly perturbed. It wasn't the bone weariness he felt, nor the fear of the unknown. He was no stranger to long marches across the harsh terrain of the frozen north. And this was springtime, the temperature still cool, but the land free of snow and ice. It was almost pleasant. As for the unknown, he'd faced that before, and he always prepared the same way. Train. Polish his armor. Oil his boots. Sharpen his sword. Focus on what he could control. That was the best he could do to ward off the anxiety that came along with new situations. No, it was none of that that perturbed him. It was her. I'm a fool, he thought now, glancing in Private Cheery's direction. Why did I invite her along? Every second in her presence seemed a distraction. The way her glossy black hair fell in waves. It's only hair, you dolt. Dead skin cells forming into tendrils of fur, meant to keep one warm. The loose, confident manner of her gait, her arms swinging at her sides. She's only walking. You've seen plenty of women walk. How her plate hugged her slender body, curving slightly at the hips and chest. It's armor, nothing you haven't seen a thousand times. Yes, this woman perturbed him greatly. Seeming to sense his gaze on her, she turned, her lips curling into a smile, her eyes sparkling in the sunlight. Snowballs and ice castles, Christoph thought. She's Terin's cousin and a soldier under your command to boot. Get a grip! He flinched away, uncomfortable under her gaze. He felt his cheeks warm to pink. In his peripheral vision, he saw her path meandering toward his own. And then she was there, by his side, the very aura of her seeming to fill him with the warmth of the sun. Which is impossible, he reminded himself. It's just a series of physical responses to stimuli. Nothing more. Her fingers brushed against his, and he almost yelped. Private Cheery, he said, casually drifting his hand away. Did you need something? She laughed in that raspy, contagious way of hers.
Yes, Captain Metz.
I wanted to request an audience in your tent this evening.
His heart skipped a beat. Again, that wasn't possible. Hearts didn't skip beats. And yet he'd felt it in his chest, like a hiccup.
For what purpose?
Strategy.
That single word seemed to hold so many hidden meanings. In the best of times, Christoph struggled when people were not literal with him.
For what? She leaned into him, bumping him slightly.
He almost stumbled, his eyes darting around to see if anyone had noticed.
The voyage ahead. What we might find across the sea. Various tactics we might use.
Maybe she means what she says. Maybe this is a good idea.
This is a terrible idea. But,
of course, after supper we shall strategize. He was surprised to find the word containing multiple meanings in his own mind.
What is this woman doing to you?
Good, she said.
And then, with a quickness that seemed to suck the breath from his very lungs, she was gone, striding away to speak to Terin and Anise. He watched her go, his heart in his throat.
A voice from behind made him jump.
Need any tips?
Archer said, grinning.
Tips for what?
Women. Despite my youthful appearance, I have a fair bit of experience.
Flames licked Christoph's cheeks.
No, it is simply your body reacting to this embarrassing conversation. A shot of adrenaline, a chemical reaction. The veins in your cheeks dilating, increasing blood flow. I am fine. I treat my female soldiers the same as the males.
I think that might be part of the problem.
I'm fine.
Archer raised his eyebrows.
Very well, sir. Do let me know if you change your mind.
Christoph was pacing his tent. He'd considered leaving his armor on, but it sorely needed a good polishing, and now it lay gleaming in neat rows. He wore tie-up trousers and a loose shirt. His belly was nearly empty, having had no appetite during dinner. The conversation had been awkward, especially considering they were such a small group. Only 13 of them, including him, Queen Anise and her brother, Lady Zelda, Terin, Sir Jonius, 3 soldiers hand-picked by Sir Dietrich, and 4 chosen by Christoph himself, including Private Cheery. Christoph frowned. No, the conversation had not been particularly awkward. Mostly they spoke of the weather, and whether they could avoid the spring squalls so common in the Crimean Sea this time of year. He had only perceived it as awkward due to the looks Mona, Private Cheery, was giving him, and the knowing looks from Archer that followed.
I am a man, a soldier, a captain. This is nothing. I will kindly tell the good private that I am feeling tired, and that it's best if—
She pushed through the flap of his tent without so much as a cleared throat, stepping inside with such familiarity it might have been her tent. She'd removed her armor, wearing only a white vest over a long-sleeved grey tunic, and a pair of black trousers that were slightly ruffled from the day's march. He'd never seen her look more beautiful. Christoph coughed, choking on his spittle.
"Private Cheery! Thank you for your punctuality. As it turns out—"
He trailed off as she stepped closer, a whiff of flowers catching his nose. They were braided into her dark locks. Hope flowers, Christoph thought, their soft pink petals flitting in and out of sight. In a rush, his feelings from before, during the battle to retake Castle Hill, poured through him like a flood. As usual, his thoughts refused to be stopped by his lips.
"I want to touch you again, like before."
He clamped his mouth shut, inwardly cursing his own bluntness. The edge of Mona's lips curled upward.
"Really?"
she purred.
"That's one order I'll have no trouble following."
Christoph gaped as she stepped closer still, until he could almost feel her breath. He hadn't meant it as an order, but she was already sliding toward him, her lips moist, her eyes piercing him like blades of green moonlight. His heart raced as one of her soft hands cupped his chin. He only flinched slightly, but it didn't deter her, didn't stop her from pulling his face toward her, from brushing her lips against his gently, just a touch at first. Like practice. Like training.
In that moment, in the tender way in which she handled his eccentricities, the parts of him that no one else seemed to understand, he found something he'd been searching for his entire life. Acceptance. Her fingers combed his hair gently, but didn't feel like a comb at all. How is that possible? Each caress like a jolt of lightning down his spine. Her lips played upon his again. Touch and release. Touch and release. Lingering longer each time. Practice. Training. Like learning sword work, perfecting his craft. He tried it, leading once, twice. His hand painted her hip. The first time was uncomfortable, and he retracted his fingers like they'd been burned. The second time was better. The third touch he held, his hand resting comfortably on her curve. Their lips moved together, and it almost felt like a dance. They did that for a long time, long enough for Christoph's fear to fade away, for it to feel like he understood what it was. Her tongue slipped in his mouth. Human saliva. A pink, floppy, slimy tongue, clacking teeth. That's how he'd always thought about the human mouth, a disgusting thing. Not Mona's. She tasted like cherry wine from the small glass they'd each drunk at supper, and there was nothing disgusting about the way her tongue found his, how it probed and played, all while his lips were hers, as close to someone as he'd ever been. And then they got closer. His hand still clasping her hip. No, both hands. When had his other hand moved into place? She pushed up against him. Something stirred inside him. That need for this woman, this one-of-a-kind woman. That want. That desire. Her lips parted from his just long enough for her to whisper, "Take me to bed." Her breath soft on his skin. In a strange four-legged dance stumble, they moved across the small space and eased down onto the lumpy bedroll, with him on his back and her on top, leaning over for another kiss. When she rose again, she began to unbutton her vest. Christoph couldn't believe his own ears when he said, "Let me." She smiled, her eyes shining, and offered a single nod. They took turns, removing scraps of clothing until it was just them, as nature intended. And it felt right. All of it felt right. Christoph was changed from the experience. No, he would not want anyone else to touch him, not even a firm handshake, but he wanted Mona to touch him, always, forever. The time they had shared bested his very best sword fights. And the way she looked at him now, resting her head on his chest, perhaps there was magic in the world. "I love you," she murmured. Christoph knew what she meant, for he felt something too, but it wasn't love. That was a term invented by humans to explain something that was out of their control. "There's no such thing," he said with certainty. "What you are feeling is just chemicals mixing in your brain, like a potion master stirring a tonic." Her eyes narrowed. "What about your parents? Didn't you love them?" Christoph appreciated the logic of her question. "I was very fond of them, yes, but I didn't love them." Her eyes pierced him.
"And what about me?"
There was a challenge in her tone.
I am very fond of you, too, but in a different way."
"What way, Christoph?"
He was a liar. For whatever reason, logic and science or something else, he'd denied himself these feelings for a long time. For if he didn't love his brother, Giordo, then losing him, failing him, wouldn't hurt as much. But hide as he might, he could still feel the loss, the pain, like an ever-present dart in his chest.
Choose your next words carefully, sir, or you might never taste..."
She kissed him.
"These."
Another kiss, her tongue flashing.
"Lips again."
"I love you," he said.
To his surprise, he meant it. She kissed him again.
34. The Western Kingdom, Bethany. Lisbeth Lorne.
I can't stop them.
The moment the words left Lisbeth's lips, she sank to her knees, the high grass tickling her skin. The sleeping knights roamed ahead, swarming over the western castle of Bethany, moonslit on the eastern shore of the Bay of Bounty. Men shouted, women screamed, babies cried. Some of them might not be innocent, but most were. A cry had gone up an hour earlier as they'd approached, but the defenders seemed too few by half.
They've all gone south, marching on the Southron gates and beyond to Fanes. They never expected an attack from the north.
Sir Dietrich said, "You can. Your power, it is greater than anything I have experienced in my life." His turquoise soul brightened as he spoke. Though she couldn't bear to trust his words, she was grateful to have the kind knight with her. The first few days he hadn't spoken much, looking dejected. When they'd passed through Raider's Pass, he'd looked downright glum. But ever since they veered westward, his mood had shifted, like a great weight had left him. She didn't need her soul mark to read into it.
"He's lived his entire life in the north, and he has few happy memories. They are many, and I am one. Their souls stretch to depths I cannot reach."
These were truths, and she knew her purpose was war. For a while she'd hoped it was to stop one. Not any more.
"I am the war-bringer. I cannot stop them, but I will bear witness to their acts. That is my fate."
A portion of Dietrich's soul reached out to touch her. His hand, she knew. But Lisbeth shied away. Even now her soul mark was beginning to pulse, lightly at first, but then stronger and stronger. To touch the knight now would kill him.
"I am a weapon."
His soul darted back, and he said, "Stop them. You can. They are yours. The world is yours if you want it." Something about the last part made her uncomfortable, but it strengthened her will just the same. She felt them, the souls of many. Some fluttered with fear, others with adrenaline and battle, and still others with a strange excitement. Many, however, had already gone dark, dead stars crashing from the heavens. Surrounding them all were larger souls, fiery red, consuming the others. Ancient death released. She pushed her soul into one of them, only it wasn't only one, for inexplicably they were all connected. You could not face one without the others, and that pit of darkness spiraled down, down, down into nothingness, the depth of the sea, perhaps, or the very core of the earth itself.
"And yet, I must go there."
Somewhere in the back of her mind she could hear Sir Dietrich continuing to speak to her, to offer words of encouragement, of comfort. The abyss surrounding her, voices roaring through her like crashing waves, laughter, death cries, the clank of sword on shield, and the sickening thuck of steel entering flesh, penetrating, ending. Still she fell, her descent uncontrolled now.
"Join us," they said. "Yes, you can be one with us. Do you feel our joy? Do you feel our purpose? Yes, for it is your joy, your purpose too."
"No!"
Lisbeth screamed, yanking back her soul with every ounce of strength she had, wrenching it from the depths of the never-ending pit until it shot back from the castle and into her forehead, that all-seeing eye, with the force of a hurled rock. She fell back, the soft grass cushioning her. Everything felt fuzzy, murky, like she was sinking into fetid waters. A voice swam through the fog. "Lisbeth! Lisbeth, are you all right?" A soul, bluer than summer sky, touched her cheek. She couldn't help herself. She needed comfort, escape from the darkness that continued to hang heavy in her mind. She gripped that soul, that kind and generous soul, the only one who hadn't abandoned her. Memories assaulted her, crystal images flashing one after another, fleeting glimpses into a life of pain, of regret, of loss, and finally, of joy. What she knew to be her own face vanished in an explosion of fragmented light, and then all went dark. Lisbeth felt like she was floating. The sharp but not unpleasant scent of burning wood hung in the air. The souls of stars winked at her from above, and the best man she had known in her short time